likely. Okay. All right, it's time for us to start. I'd like to welcome you to session number 274, A Murder of Editors. This is going to be a session where we talk about what's going on in the editing world of Mormon publications. And it's going to be a panel discussion. We hope to get some participation from the audience as we go through this, and we hope that Darlene doesn't freeze completely. So let me introduce the people that we have here. We have me, I'm the editor of Sunstone, and we have Sheila Miner, who has an MA in American Culture Studies, and she's also the feature editors of Segula. And she's also a blogger on Feminist Mormon Housewives. We also have Angela Hallstrom, who has an MFA in creative writing, and she's the co-editor of Erie Antum, and also, might I mention, the author of a multiple award-winning novel, Bound on Earth. It got both the Whitney Award for the best first novel and the AML Award for best novel of the year. So she's a rising star, someone you should watch. And we've got Mike Hunter, who is the academic review editor for New Media at BYU Studies, and also a member of the BYU Studies Academy. He's actually studying the medium that's seeking to displace the paper publications. So I'm really interested in what he has to say. And you're our friend, Mike. You need to help us see the light. And we also have Christine Haglund, who has an MA in German Studies, and she is the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. So as you can see, we have most of the main players here from Mormon publications. So you're going to be able to pick the minds of these people here. My uncle, Paul Swenson, is going to be session hopping and said that he wanted to hear what I had to say, and I hate to disappoint my Uncle Paul. So do you guys mind if I go first, and then we'll just sort of go down the row? Okay, we'll do that. All right, I'm first then. Yesterday, the Thursday morning session, Tanya Rand's Lions session entitled If Toyota Ran the Church provided a metaphor that I want to base my thoughts on. In her presentation, she told a little bit of history about Toyota and how in the early part of the last century, Toyota went to the Ford Company in America to learn the tricks of the automotive trade. And they learned a lot of things, and they brought it back to Japan. But when they got to Japan, they realized, well, the things that Ford taught us, we have to work with them a little bit, to make them meet with the smaller economy, with the different sorts of people who live in Japan. And so they started working with that. Then along came World War II, and it pretty much, you know, destroyed Japanese economy. Toyota barely survived, and then they had even more to deal with. They had a flailing economy to try to stay alive in and make cars. And so they went back to the Ford Company, thinking the Ford Company just went through a war as well, so certainly they should be able to tell us something, we should be able to mix juices. But when they got there, they found out that the war had in fact boosted the American economy and had given Ford all the money and stuff that they needed to make all sorts of stuff. And so Ford had not in fact innovated at all. And so they went back kind of disappointed and realized that they had to make their company from the ground up according to the principles that would work for them. So this is what I'm going to present, and if you're interested, I'd be really interested in your responses. What I'm hoping to do is present two principles that can perhaps be the Toyota principles of the future of Mormon publishing. And the main criterion that I have for these principles is that they sacrifice short-term gains for long-term success. Apparently, this is one of the main things that sets Toyota off from the majority of automotive companies and businesses in general, is that they're willing to forego instant gratification for the eternal perspective. So, let's see. So Mormon Publishing, in my view, is now heading into lean times, just the way... Are you guys laughing at me?
No, just near you.
You're laughing near me. Thank you. So, Mormon Publishing, we could say, is going into lean times the same way that that the Japanese automotive industry was going into lean times after World War II. There are three reasons for this. The first one is that the internet has simultaneously promoted and devalued information. You know, as Stuart Brand famously puts it, information wants to be free. And right now that's the predominant idea among the vast majority of consumers of information. They want it to be free. And so even if you never bought a book or a magazine again in your entire life, the internet would provide you with the reading material that you would need for the rest of your life. It's kind of like having an endless supply of marshmallow mateys in your storage room. You will always be able to eat, thanks to the internet. Number two is that is this recession that's sitting on us. I'm sure that that everybody sitting up on this table has seen probably a little bit of a dip in their subscription rates and a dip in the donation rates. I mean, even I think, well, gee whiz, do I want to donate to UNICEF or do I want to, you know, feed my family? And obviously I want to feed my family first. And everybody's going through that and they wonder just how important is it to keep these publications going. I'm going to argue about that in just a minute. The third thing that's put us into lean times is the blogs. Now, I actually like blogs. I run one myself. Some of my best friends have blogs going. And I also think blogs are an unparalleled tool for community building, which I think is the most important things that humans can do. But, as I mentioned before, blogs have also taken away, in a large extent, our audience because people can involve themselves in almost real-time conversations, which we love. So those are the three things. Internet culture free, the recession, and the blogs. They all militate against traditional publications. They dry up our revenue sources, devalue our product, meaning things that are heavily edited, and steal the audience, even though I think that where the audience is going on the blogs is a very healthy and wonderful place. It almost makes me question publications. So in the face of these lean times, I'm hoping that we can come up with some principles that will help us to make Mormon Publishing into something that can continue to be viable and continue to contribute to Mormon culture, to make it a place where wonderful things can happen. I think Mormon culture is a place where those sorts of things can happen. So, the first one is that I think we need to do a much more significant focus on quality, because this is the one thing that blogs can't offer at the moment. Blog posts aren't meant to be of high literary quality. They're meant to start conversations. And they do a great job at that. The beauty of a blog post is its colloquialism, its immediate access to a person's inner state, and its ability to elicit reactions from other people. And in these ways, there are some virtuoso bloggers out there, and I really respect their abilities to be able to do that. But the thing that they can't produce are more lengthy, involved, nuanced, complex works that, period. They can't produce those things. Why do we need those things? We all know that it's sometimes difficult to delve down into these more nuanced, longer, complex works, but when we do this, it is a kind of soul work. We find out more about the world. We find out more about ourselves. And we watch a mind or a set of minds engaged in a great struggle that has been polished and culminated into something of great substance. And this is something that I haven't seen if blogs can do yet. I think that the medium of blogs doesn't allow that, or at least discourages it. And if any of my blogging friends here want to take me on that, I'd love to hear about it, because I might be wrong. But this is the thing that Mormon publications can give. Because when you commit something to paper, you don't want to put ephemeral stuff on there. You want things that are going to stay, and that when people read it in 50, 100, 200 years, they're going to say, wow, what an amazing encapsulation of the zeitgeist or of what was going on there. Isn't it wonderful to see so deeply into the heart of the culture and the people of that time in such a beautifully crafted work? So it's sort of like everybody reads Tess d'Urberville's or Jude the Obscure, but very few people read Thomas Hardy's letters, right? Okay, not everybody reads his novels, but a lot more people read his novels than read his letters. And so the novels are what make us appreciate the Victorian era. Blah, 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 blah. You get my idea. Okay. The second Toyota principle is the one that I think is the most important, and actually one that I think will take huge amounts of work, but might be the greatest thing that has ever happened to us. I think that unity is going to be something that we're going to have to work hard to get in the Mormon publication world. I think we need to start hanging together, lest, as Benjamin Franklin put it, we hang separately. Not just because of like money and stuff like that. It used to be, though, that there was a lot more money to go around. And with all of this money, we were able to start drawing political lines much pretty easily. We, in a lot of ways, defined ourselves against each other. We put together our magazine because it wasn't this, or it wasn't that. And I think we started to divide up Mormonism. In some ways, this might have been a good thing. It might have helped us to be able to think about Mormonism in ways that we hadn't been able to do before. But times being what they are, I think we need to start making moves to more of a synthesis. We've created the thesis and the antithesis, but I don't think we should stop there at all. What I think we need to do is to start, let me see how I put it. I think we need to focus more on the things that vitalize and unify us as a Mormon community. I think we need to break down some of the factionalism that has been going on. I think we need to start trusting each other a little more. And by that, I was reading an interview and dialogue with a media expert. Maybe you can remind me of who this
John
is.
Peterson.
With who?
John Jerome Peterson.
That's it. And he said something that really struck me. He said that one of the reasons that he doesn't trust intellectuals in the church very much, which is funny because he's a very smart man, is that he said that it seems that we tend to look to change other people, to bring other people to our way of thinking, and he said he thought that the main challenge of the intellectual is to understand the other. It's not to separate ourselves from our orthodox neighbors or our less intellectual neighbors, but to find a way to open our souls large enough so that we can come into community with these people. Think about Martin Buber's concept of I, it, and I, thou. We're definitely in an I, it culture. How difficult is it to come into an I, thou culture? It's very difficult, because in a lot of ways we have to lose our ego. We have to go into the ordeal of finding each other, of empathizing with each other. This is what Jesus wanted us to do, in my opinion. He was interested in people empathizing with each other and understanding each other. This is why, as Jean England argued, having geographically bound wards is a very Christian way to go about putting together a congregation, because then you're in with people that you did not choose. I really appreciate being at a Sunstone Symposium or at an AML conference, because I am with people with whom I share a mythological structure, with whom I share a lot of foundational ideas, and I appreciate being able to commune with them. It is at these symposia where I feel like I am most able to drop my masks and be honest with people. But I think Jesus would ask me to work much harder to come into communion with the people who are very different from me. And I think he would also promise me that my soul would become larger if I can understand people who are so entirely different from me. So this is where I think the gospel calls those of us who are trying to make a conversation in Mormonism. For me, it's our job as editors, especially now, to help each other understand each other. When we come together with disparate points of view, we shouldn't, in my opinion, be coming together to show that one is right or what is wrong, but rather to go deeper into each other and see kind of how Wayne Booth was saying in that art, in that review that I put up on the Red Brick Store recently, not just to tolerate each other or to be good humored with each other, but to dig down beneath the top layers, down to the place where our common humanity meets, so that we can be talking with each other at a very deep level and experience a community of saints. So this is where I'm hoping that Mormon Publishing can go. I'm hoping that this will make us that this will be a good long-term direction, because then it will start bringing us together more, and hopefully start a conversation that people really want to be a part of, instead of dividing ourselves up. But these are ideas that I've come up with in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and they're tentative. I'm still trying to figure them out, and they would do well with some debate from anybody who is seeing other things than what I'm saying. So if you want to catch me like during the Q&A or afterward, I really want to hear about this, because I feel in some ways like I'm going out on a limb. So thanks for listening, Jimmy. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'm Sheila Miner, and I'm here representing Segala. The first thing I want everybody to do, and this is sort of a group exercise, is I want you to work with me on the name of the journal. It's Segala. It's not Segula. It's not Segala. Although I, for a year after joining the staff, called it Segala. It rhymes with ooh-la-la. So let's work on it together, guys. Segala. Segala. Okay, and we are sort of the baby sister on the Mormon publishing scene. Segala is a Hebrew word meaning peculiar treasure. And it was used in Exodus. It comes from Exodus 19:5, used by the Lord to designate a covenant people set apart from the world. And I'm going to give, because we're only 4 years in existence, and as I said before, kind of the baby sister, I'm going to give a little bit of our history, just because I'm not sure how many people in the audience are all that familiar with who we are and where we come from. The journal's tagline has been Writings by Latter-day Saint Women. And over the next year, I think we're kind of going to be developing a new official tagline, but our new tagline is going to be community and creativity among women, I think. I know that there's community and creativity in there, and I should have had it written down, but I don't. The journal is designed to encourage literary, part of our mission statement is to encourage literary talent, provoke thought, and promote greater understanding and faith among Latter-day Saint women. The majority of what we publish kind of falls in the creative nonfiction era. We also have a large handful of poetry, a few features, and a featured artist in each issue. But mostly we're interested in the personal stories of Latter-day Saint women. And so you'll keep coming back. I think the personal stories and the community are two things that are really big for Segala. Our first issue is published in the spring of 2005. And we originally published our journal 3 times a year, but the last few years we focused on 2 issues, one of which includes winners from our Heather Campbell personal essay contest and also our poetry contest. Our claim to fame is that we are probably the only Mormon publication that can claim that it was born inside of a fast food restaurant. It was actually a McDonald's in Lehigh, where Kathy Soper, who's been our editor-in-chief since the journal's inception, Justine Dorton, who's our managing editor, and Kylie Turley, who's now an advisor, came up with the idea for the journal over the shouts of their children in the playland. They soon, they had this great brainstorm, and over the course of the next few months turned the brainstorm into something real. They recruited an advisory board, which included Boyd Peterson and Cherry Silver, and recruited also Jonna Cornett as our webmaster. And if you are familiar with our website, you know that Jonna has played a huge role in shaping the direction of Segala over the last few years. One thing that also is interesting about our journal is that we have a very large editorial board. And that comes, I think, from friends recruiting their writing friends. As of this morning, there were 61 current and former members registered on our message board. And our message board is all of our current staff and people who have been on staff in the past, although there really aren't that many emeritus members there. I would say that probably 50 of those 61 people have some sort of active role in the journal or the blog, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And I think that huge number, while it may seem unwieldy, is also significant, because I think, once again, it emphasizes that Segala is a lot about building community and also about encouraging writers. And I know that I joined the staff shortly, or a little bit more than a year ago, and I had been asked to be a guest blogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives, and within a day or two, somebody of my first guest post there, someone who I'd gone to college with, sent me an email and said, "Hey, I don't know if you know anything about Segala, but if you do, I work on, and this was Emily Milner, who's been our associate editor, I work on the staff, I'd love to have you work with us. And I think that's how I think that's how a lot of us end up have ended up working on the staff. And within a month, I mean, I'd never really written more than college essays and blogs, and within a month, I was working on my first personal essay, and it was really a transforming experience for me because there was so much feedback, which is, you know, something that I had never really had before or known that I needed. So it was both a humbling and an empowering experience for me. One of the other things that makes Segala unique is the presence of our blog, which has in the last few years become as large or possibly even a larger presence than our journal. We have a daily blog. It's written primarily by our journal staff, and we're proud to say that we won the Niblet for the best group blog this year. We have more individual visits to the blog on an average day than we have subscribers to our print journal. And we also have a really active online community of commenters. So I think, once again, this brings back the idea that community and creativity are something that's really needed and really sought out among LDS women. Another thing that that is unique, I would say, among the publications here, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, is that we have a full text of our journal is available online for free shortly after the publication. And I know that we've talked as editors before that, you know, some of the journals are print only and some are print, but you can buy the online edition, and some where you can have selections that are available online. I think we're one of the only places that print, that has full text of our journal available for free. What does? Exponent, but do they still do a print? I thought that they were only.
You're right.
So I think so this is kind of a double-edged sword. It allows more readers access to the journal. And I don't have the stats on this, but I would guess that we probably have at least as many people reading it as online as we do receiving the print version. But as Stephen was talking about before, it probably also in some ways limits our revenue. We also have a nonprofit arm, which has published several books, with a couple more books in the works. Now, we've been asked a little bit to talk about struggle. So there were a couple areas of struggle that would be good to cover as far as Segala goes. The first is sort of historical and editorial area. As Mormon publications, we're all to some degree sort of a niche market. But I would say, as a publication for Latter-day Saint women, we're very niche for a couple of reasons. And I love what you said about broadening and like embracing each other, because we've got our writing. First of all, is done by and primarily for women. I mean, that's been in the subtitle of the journal since the very beginning. We have had He Says articles a few times, although I don't think we even really do those very much anymore. So it's an estrogen fest over at Segala. And another thing is that with a strong blog presence, it attracts women who are comfortable with electronic technology, which I would say possibly makes our audience skew a little bit younger as well. And it's also not an accident that we identify as Latter-day Saint rather than as Mormon. Our mission statement says, "We publish insightful writings which explore life's richness and complexity while reflecting the faithfulness of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our aim is to highlight a variety of women's perspectives within a framework of shared beliefs and values." So our mission statement comes very firmly from within within embracing, you know, embracing the gospel. But that doesn't mean it's the Ensign. It doesn't mean it's Relief Society. And I think you'll see that in just a minute as I talk about some of the difficult and complex topics that we want to wrestle with from a perspective of faith. Another thing that, as a historical and editorial struggle, is that we're always eager, because, you know, because of where we started, we're eager to expand both our pool of writers and readers from beyond the stay-at-home moms who are supervising their kids at the Playland. While I think it's great that we have, there is a high-quality creative outlet for good writing at Segalov, for where writers feel comfortable and get a lot of support through the editorial process. We don't want it only to be limited to that demographic. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit, because I've just said how we're all within the framework of faithfulness to the gospel of Jesus Christ. I want to talk about some of the things that we have discussed in our last 4 years without we've had an essay called Living Water, which is about which was a personal essay about a writer's experience with abortion. Another about called You Just Have to Love, relating to a relationship with a homosexual son. We've had an essay called A Marvelous Work in a Wonder Bra, which is about breast reduction surgery, purging addiction, about eating disorders, When Life Begins, which is about IVF, another called In Honor of Feisty Marriages. And so we've addressed conflict on a number of fronts. And while we don't establish the challenge the establishment in terms of standards and doctrines and policies, we do give women the space to explore and discuss the challenges and complexities of living within these parameters, and try to give them the space to challenge elements of church culture. While we probably wouldn't print an essay that takes the church's policy on homosexuality to bat, we would publish one that discusses a woman's difficult or complex experience with living with that policy. We might not print an essay that says prophets are wrong to encourage moms to stay at home, but would print one written by a working mom who explores her experiences. So I think that that we're trying to dance around in the gray areas within the parameters of the establishment. We might not think it's our prerogative to change the establishment, but we do think it's our prerogative to influence church culture. And in that line, I wanted to kind of close my little part with a poem from Darlene Young, who's here today, which was my first experience with Segalov when I got the email from Emily. She included a link to this poem, and I think it perfectly encapsulates what we're about. And it's called Angels of Mercy, and I hope I don't read it badly. So it says, "The Seventh Ward Relief Society presidency argued long and soft whether Janie Goodmanson deserves to have the sisters bring her family meals. It seemed that the precedent was vague. No one was sure if boob job qualified as a legitimate call for aid. Janie herself had never asked, a fault they found it harder to forgive than the vanity behind the worldliness of D-cup ambition. But in the end, charity did not fail. The sisters marched on in grim duty each evening, clutching covered casseroles, for after all, it wasn't the children's fault. More than once, though, by some oversight, the dessert came out a little short, as if by some consensus they knew that Janie's husband, Jim, could do without a piece of pie that night." So, yeah, that's where we want to come from. And just to let everyone know, in 2010, we are celebrating our fifth anniversary, and we're planning a special big issue. Our theme is going to be dating, courtship, and marriage. We're going to have our first ever community event. And so that's where Segalov's coming from. So.
I'm Mike Hunter, and I'm one of 39 volunteer academic editors at BYU Studies. When Stephen was talking about breaking down barriers, I guess he was serious. I mean, I'm proof that he's very serious about that. He's invited BYU Studies here today to be a part of this, and I appreciate the fact that he did. I think it's a very important discussion. I was thinking, when he said challenges, meeting the budget and making the deadlines and so forth, and after he spoke, I didn't realize he had such deep thoughts on the subject, or I would have made sure they sent someone else here. But I do have some comments on what he had to say. I'm a volunteer editor at BYU Studies. My day job is Mormon Studies librarian at the Harold B. Lee Library at BYU. And so I purchase all of the Mormon materials and subscribe to all the Mormon journals. I checked to make sure before I left, and as far as I can determine, we subscribe to 24 magazines and or journals that are specifically LDS journals. And when I have told people that, they're amazed that there's so many journals that are specifically geared towards Latter-day Saints and Latter-day Saint or Latter-day Saint topics. And that's a good reason why I prepared notes to tell you a little bit about BYU Studies, because many of those journals you probably have never heard of, and so I'm not going to assume that you know anything about BYU Studies either. BYU Studies, one of the challenges we face is name recognition. BYU Studies confuses people. What is BYU Studies? Is it for BYU, about BYU, for BYU students, or for BYU faculty, about BYU? You know, what is it? And so name recognition is one of the things that we struggle with, is explaining what we are. So I would like to tell you, just as the others, a little bit about BYU Studies and some of the challenges that we face, and then talk a little bit more about my role as new media editor, which is the reason I think maybe I am here, and comment on some of the comments that Stephen made. First of all, this is the 50th anniversary of BYU Studies. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary this year. BYU Studies' mission has not really changed in those 50 years. We have always been a place where interested individuals and scholars can come together and explore truth in an environment where there's reason and revelation, or by study and also by faith, as it says in the Doctrine and Covenants. BYU Studies currently has 4,000 subscribers in 16 countries, 21 employees, and 39, like I said, volunteer academic editors who are both on and off campus, volunteer their time to help with that. BYU Studies has always been about excellent scholarship, and we think that that is still our goal, is to publish excellent scholarship. BYU Studies has an academy, BYU Studies Academy. It's composed of about 100 scholars and specialists from BYU and the larger LDS community who volunteer their time to promote LDS scholarship at BYU Studies. And we have issues of our journal going into 300 libraries across the country. Having said all that, some of the challenges that we face. BYU Studies is a multidisciplinary journal and has been from the beginning, meaning that we will take any topic in any discipline and cover it in BYU Studies, so long as it's well-written and grounded in sound scholarship and maintains a respectful tone, which is important to us at BYU Studies. Unity and charity are core principles of what we're looking for there. We have had recent articles that deal with civil engineering. Civil engineers wrote the article on the draining of Nauvoo. We had a recent forensics analysis of the assassination of Joseph Smith. And we had an entire issue devoted to Mozart's magic flute. So we cover all topics. Some of them that I could think of are history, anthropology, art history, comparative literature, law, music, religion, theater, film, and even management. So all topics are open for submissions there. This general approach does have its challenges. One of those challenges is it means we have to find specialists in all disciplines to review the submissions that we have that come into BYU Studies. And so we seek after specialists that are LDS or non-LDS who can review our submissions and do the peer reviewing for that. We have the challenge of making sure that we're fair to all the everyone that submits an article to us. We can only a quarter of all submissions make it actually into publication in the journal. We receive about 150 article length manuscripts a year and have to select, the editorial boards have to select, and it's difficult sometimes to select. We want things that are high quality and have staying power, and as all these editors have, and it was alluded to by Stephen, how do you know what has staying power and what doesn't? You know, these are tricky challenges. We have the challenge of managing in an increasingly complex environment where there are both electronic journals and print journals in the mix, and we also publish both in print and electronically online. Keeping up with technology and the way that individuals are receiving the information has become increasingly complex. In the past, people received their journal, it was printed, and it was mailed to them, and they received it in the mail. The online environment does make it much more dynamic, but also a lot more complex for the publishers of academic journals. The economics involved in that also is difficult. I'll talk about that in a minute. So what are we doing at BYU Studies in regards to this? Well, one thing we have done is we do have a website, and we will have a new website coming up in the next couple of weeks. And that website has freely available to anyone from 1959 to 2007 full issues of BYU Studies that you could download as PDFs, and you have free access to that. We have a different model. We don't put it up immediately online. We have a two-year. This is the model that most people and most journals are following, where there's a delayed online presence so that it doesn't cut in too much to the subscriptions. But those 2 years that aren't online for free, you can go online and you can purchase a single article, or you can purchase the entire journal. We're looking into having an online push to you. Right now you have to go to the website and you choose to download the article, but we're looking at subscriptions that will just go online through a PDF where it's pushed to you. We have had to look at new media and what's available and how especially younger generations want their information to come to them. And so we have RSS feeds, podcast, presence on Twitter and Facebook, and all of these will be part of our new website that's coming out in the next few weeks. Blogging is something that we have been looking at for some time, and we do have plans for a blog which will mirror the journal in the sense that it's a place where people can come together and discuss scholarship or discuss Latter-day Saint topics in a scholarly manner and in a manner in which you can blend reason and revelation. And so we're looking at all of that. Just to comment on some of the thoughts that Stephen had, I'm very appreciative of the fact that he wants to have collaboration and to break down walls and barriers, and I think that is an important thing. Collaboration is one of the means that we have to progress in what has become a difficult economic environment. In the past, and I've been collecting Mormon materials for libraries for over 20 years now, and I've seen a lot of periodicals, LDS related, come and last a couple years and go. And I think that those that have staying power are in many ways like the church. They're willing to adapt and to change and to make adjustments along the way to remain relevant to those that are the customer base for that particular journal. And so I don't see print journals, as a librarian who loves print, loves books as well as a lot of online, I like online. I think there's a place when we talk about not being in competition but collaborating. I see online journals and online blogs and podcasts and other things as being an environment in which we can all collaborate and where it can enhance both the, it can do things that the print can't do, but the print can do things that the online can't do. And Stephen's already talked about the deep scholarship, the time and effort that goes into the editorial process for quality. That is lacking, although there's some journals online, such as the journal, the European Mormon History Association's journal online. They are putting their journals, their journal immediately online, or you can, this is a different model, so I guess you're not the only one because they do have theirs online for free, but their model is if you want to print, you can have a print version. So I'll go back. You are still, you can have a print version, but it's print on demand through Lulu. So you have people trying all different kinds of things. And I think that they're putting it online immediately, but yet there's people that still want to print. And why do people still want to print? Well, when I look at an issue of BYU studies, I think they're beautiful because they really work hard at the images, the color. It has a lot of color. The paper is very nice and glossy. And a lot of images. It's just visually appealing. And so when I sit down with my BYU studies or any of these other journals, I like to sit in my recliner and kind of read them. And if I'm at work and I'm doing research, then I don't want to be digging through all of my print issues of BYU studies or any of these other journals. I want to quickly type it in and search for what I want online. And so there's researchers that when you're doing your research, you may want something online, you may want it quickly available to you, or if you travel, you want it quickly available to you where you can access it online. So there's two reasons why you might want to print versus, there's a reason you'd want to print versus the online, and I think there's a place for both of those. There's things that the new media does for the online, does for the print that the print can't do for itself. For example, you can do a podcast where you have an interview, an in-depth interview with the author about their article and their background research, things that didn't go into the article. That enhances what you are reading in the journal. This is similar to what you see with the media on television. You have a PBS show that you really enjoyed. Well, you can go onto their website and get more in-depth information that they couldn't put on that one episode. And so blogs can do this as well, where people can have a whole community because people want to. The thing that blogs have going for them is that you're not passive. You're engaged and you're part of that community and you're contributing to that community. And I think that what blogs do, we need that with our journals because you have an article, you're interested in it, you want to talk to people about it. You can go on a blog that's around that particular print publication and then start engaging and learning and discussing it. And so I see it as being a place where there are things for both that can be there. And I just wanted to make that clear. I'm not against print. I love print. I don't see the other as really competition. I see the other as being in this where we can collaborate together. Ultimately, I suppose the challenge that we all face is the search for and the gathering of truth. And that's why you come to a symposium like this, is that you're looking for understanding the truth. And we feel that our journals are very important to this. And even though economically, in the past, no matter what time period you're talking about, it's been tough to publish an academic journal because, let's face it, our readership is small, a small community. The people who read our journal also read these other journals, so our subscriber base is probably the same people, very similar people anyway. And academic publishing has always been kind of a tough sell, but there are those out there that feel that it's important enough that they volunteer their time. You saw that she has 60 people volunteer. That's incredible. And so you have people that are engaged and interested and think that it's important enough to make sure that excellent scholarship and writing, fiction and nonfiction, is done in an excellent way with quality and put out there so that the readers who also want to engage in this community and are doing this in different ways can do so. And so I think that our search for truth is what brings us all together. So, Stephen, when you're looking for common ground, I think that's one of the areas we should focus on, is just our common interest in finding truth and understanding. Thank you.
I'm having my good friend Darlene do some shameless Irianton promotion for me.
You should all subscribe. It's a great magazine.
You should.
Best fiction out there.
Well, I'm Angela Hallstrom, and I'm the co-editor with Jack Harrell of Irianton. And since Irianton is also rather new to the scene, not as new as Segula, but still rather new, I just wanted to make sure everyone was familiar with Irianton and where we came from and where we hope to be going. Irianton began 10 years ago. We're just celebrating our 10-year anniversary this year. It began as an outgrowth of the Association for Mormon Letters, which has been around since 1976. And for many, many years, the Association for Mormon Letters had symposia and awards and a very active AML list, an online list, which is how I got involved with the AML in the first place, because before blogs became big, the AML list was hopping. It's declined a little bit since blogs stole all of our thunder, but that's how I became involved with the AML myself. But they had a newsletter, and in 1999, Chris Bigelow and Benson Parkinson decided that they were going to take that newsletter and turn it into a magazine. And the name they came up with was Irianton. And the reason they chose it was much like the reason that the people at Segula chose their name, was because it was obscure and difficult to pronounce. No, it was taken from the Book of Mormon. And from 1 Nephi 17, we beheld the sea, which we called Irianton, which being interpreted as many waters, which I think should be indicative of the many different voices, the many different means of expression that should be found within Irianton's pages. This is an example of one of the early Irianton magazines. This was a special Eugene England's Literary Legacy version of Irianton. And by the way, we have many back issues that can be purchased at the website if you're interested in any of these. They're just treasures. So Chris Bigelow, Benson Parkinson was there for about a year, and then Chris Bigelow took over and basically ran the show as managing editor and editor-in-chief for 4 more years, for 5 years total. And when he stepped down, there was a little unsurety whether or not Irianton would be one of those magazines that was mentioned that came on the scene and then died. But luckily, Lorraine Wilkins came on board as the new editor-in-chief of Irianton. And I joined Irianton staff that year as well, in 2004, under Lorraine. And Lorraine, here's Lorraine's very first issue of Irianton. So you can see the look of Irianton started to change there with Lorraine. Lorraine had a number of changes that she wanted to institute. She included themed issues, she expanded the role of scholarly or critical essays, and since she was a poet, she was more focused on finding good poetry and promoting good poetry. She also felt very strongly that Irianton appealed to a wide range of potential readers. She very much wanted to be inclusive. She wanted those who were longtime members of the church with pioneer heritages, who were active, to feel like this was a magazine for them, but also people who may no longer be members of the church, or even those who are interested in Mormonism but don't really have an official affiliation with the church, to be able to look to Irianton and say, this is a literary magazine that is worthwhile, it's enlightening, it's creative, invigorating, all those good things that you want a literary magazine to be. That's what Lorraine envisioned. Tragically, Lorraine passed away after an auto accident in 2006, which was a very difficult time for the magazine, but her intelligence and her compassion and her vision for the magazine continue with the magazine today. After she passed away, there was a little bit of flux as far as editors went. Scott Hatch and Valerie Holiday were editors, co-editors. I did one issue, and then they did a few, and then I did one. It was all kind of a big co-editorship was going on. And the magazine began to change once again. And the main change that we see with Irriantum as it is going forward, at least with the vision that we have now, is that we really want Irriantum to be a literary magazine in the best sense of the word. That if you're looking at literary magazines that you might have some familiarity with, say like the Paris Review or Western Humanities Review, or literary magazines that the focus is primarily creative, that is the direction that we want Irriantum to go in, specifically because there is so much literary talent in Mormonism. And unfortunately, literary talent often gets the short end of the stick. If you say Mormon fiction, many times people won't even bother to listen to anyone talk about Mormon fiction because they already have preconceived notions about the quality of Mormon fiction. I'm here to tell you that the quality of Mormon fiction is exceptional. And Irriantum is a place that's definitely being shown. We want to highlight fiction, poetry, memoir, also reviews, and we're hoping to start having more interviews and things that were in the original Irriantums that were published by Chris Bigelow. So that's basically, just in a nutshell, the history of Irriantum. What we do now is we have one issue a year. Jack Harrell is the new co-editor with me. I publish the fall issue of Irriantum, and Jack publishes the spring issue of Irriantum. This was a double issue, so it's a little fatter than a regular issue would be. But this was the double issue that just recently was published this last year. And it was really good, and you should get it. It had a lot of great stuff in it. And one of the other things that we're doing now, too, is we're focusing a lot on our contests. We're getting a lot of great submissions through our contests. We've had a fiction contest for years. The Irriantum Fiction Contest, just as a little aside, was, even though I'd had a story published in the New Era, but I don't want anyone to ever read it because it was terrible. But in 2001, before I was involved with Irriantum, I submitted to the Irriantum Fiction Contest, and I won second place in between Coke Newell, who won first place and third place, both. But that was beyond anything that's happened, beyond a novel of mine being published or any other awards that I've received. Getting second place in the Irriantum Fiction Contest was the single most exciting literary event of my whole entire life. I don't think anything will ever match it, because it said to me, you know what, maybe you can write. Holy cow, maybe you can write. And one of the reasons I'm still so passionate about Irriantum, even though it's a lot of work, is because I know that there are so many writers out there who are in the exact same position, who through a contest or through just submitting to the journal might have someone give them that little nudge that they need to say, you know what, you can write and we will publish you, and that can be a stepping stone to a real literary career. And I think that is very important to encourage within Mormonism. And I think the reason that it's important to encourage is, I wrote down one of the many brilliant things that Stephen said in his opening statement, but one of the things he said that was so brilliant I wrote it down, was that one of the things that we can do with our journals is that we can help each other understand each other through our journals. And I believe that with all my heart. I think that is why we write and that is why we read, is so that we can have community. And stories, Jesus knew this best of all because he taught in parables, but stories are really where we can come together, I think. And that sometimes the battle lines that are drawn, if you're talking about something directly, can be softened when you're telling a story. And that when I publish stories, not I publish them, but when Irriantum publishes stories that are about a variety of different struggles, because in fiction, you know, the old saying is only conflict is interesting. So in fiction, there is always going to be conflict, or else you're not going to get published. But there's going to be conflict, and that conflict is going to have to be addressed, and it's going to have to be resolved in some way. And that I believe that in highlighting our artistic endeavors in this way, that we can have some of the conversations that we need to be having in order to come together as a community of saints. So while Irientum's readership is small, it's very small, it's probably the smallest of everyone up here, one of the reasons that we keep doing it and we keep plugging away is because those of us who are involved with Irientum believe that very strongly, that through our art and through our stories, we will be able to help broaden the reach and the blessings that come from being LDS and from our culture and from all the many gifts that we receive because of that. So I will just close by saying, anytime that you're engaged in anything literary or publishing or any of these endeavors, often it can be a lonely job and it can be a difficult job, and sometimes you wonder if anyone's even listening to you. And sometimes it might be true that, especially with a very small magazine like ours, that very few people are listening to us. And that there are times that I wonder, especially with a journal like Irientum, where our readership is small, our staff is very small. I wish we had the... I'm actually on the board of Segula, too, and sometimes I look at Segula and all the people who are helping and on the board, and it just makes me think, oh, I wish I could get that at Irientum. We've had a harder time. It's a small staff, and I won't lie, it's a lot of work, and it's all volunteer. Nobody's paid anything to do Irientum, and it's one of those things that there are times that you think, why are we doing this? This is a lot of work. But, as the theme of this panel is struggle, ultimately, anything that is worth it is hard. Anything that's worth it is hard. And writing is hard. Telling stories truthfully is hard. Putting those stories out there for other people to learn from or have conversations about is hard. But in the end, I have to believe it's worth it. And that's why I believe that we all do what we do. Thank you.
Plug this in lest I abruptly run out of things to say. Stephen and I had a conversation last night before I scurried off to write my presentation, so I apologize if I've stolen his ideas and articulated them less well, which is likely. For many years, the problem of Mormon artists was largely to escape the bounds of their parochialism in Utah. Mormon artists were sent on missions, famously to Paris to study art, but also to Boston to study music and medicine, and to Chicago to study theology and law and science. We were eager to be taught the methodologies of the world, even as we sneered at their philosophies. It's then a bit puzzling to find ourselves having really arrived in some ways. We are technologically sophisticated, increasingly accomplished in the academy with Mormon studies programs and courses in major universities, in politics with our first real-ish presidential candidate. In literature, we have both critically acclaimed authors and our very own publishing phenomenon. Those are not necessarily coextensive sets. But we have, finally, a culture that is, in many respects, as sophisticated and fully achieved as the wider American culture. Alas, for would-be publishers and purveyors and creators of that cultural richesse, we are also fully embedded in a broader American society that has apparently decided that cultural production is not something one ought to value, at least not by actually paying for it. There's an unnervingly real possibility that rising generations of Mormons able to access the New Era and the Ensign online for free, or for only 10% of their income, will simply decide that that's enough, that any engagement with Mormon culture that costs money is uninteresting to them. And the reasons for this we've all kind of touched on, but I'll just enumerate them at length because I am Swedish. Blogging, tweeting, Facebooking, and other forms of online publishing are cheap or free. Barriers to entrance for either consumption or expression are quite low. It's ubiquitous and immediate. And most importantly, as people have noted, it creates a sense of community. Although it may not have been a deliberate intent of Dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2, and all of these other older journals at their founding, it seems clear to me that one of the major functions that they have served over the years is to provide a sense of community for those whose intellectual proclivities or political convictions or background experiences make it difficult for them to experience such community in their geographically assigned congregations. The most important content of these journals has always been extratextual. Every article, every essay proclaims, above all, you are not alone. Other Mormons share your questions and may even have useful answers to some of them. This crucial function of the journals is in some ways better served by blogs or Facebook groups or the insistent, relentless virtual communing of Twitterers. The gathering of vaguely like-minded folk, once represented by the quarterly arrival of a journal or an annual symposium, has been replaced by ongoing convocations of highly specialized like-mindedness from positions all along the orthodoxy spectrum and areas of interest. One can pick one's level of affiliation or disaffection within fine gradations, from blogs composed almost entirely of lengthy quotations from general authorities to New Order Mormons, the Disaffected Mormon Underground, or exmormon.org. In short, I can have a Sunstone Symposium in my living room every night if I want to, but never in the bedroom. That's how rumors start. The informality of these communities is part of their appeal, as is their participatory nature. It turns out that people really like to hear themselves talk. A certain egalitarianism and democratic ethos prevails. Authority and credentials are unimportant. The degree to which one's opinion is reasonably well-informed can be less important than whether one states it provocatively or just with sufficient bombast. The really interesting part of this to me is that this democratic ethos is also signifies some of the challenges presented to the institutional church by these new media. While most Mormons are still highly conditioned to value and defer to official pronouncements and respect ecclesiastical authority, new modes of publishing and online communication invite, even demand, challenges to that authority. Blogging provides every woman and every man a printing press and an essentially infinite number of virtual church doors. Typepad and Blogspot cry out for the posting of theses, which will, in a world subject to the forces of entropy, inevitably tend towards heresy. And aren't we all glad? Let's see. Another threatening technological development is just the sheer volume of information that's available. With the advent of nanotechnology, the driving motivation for correlation to make the church portable and streamlined enough to fit on the back of a camel, in Elder Packer's memorable formulation, no longer exists. Lesson manuals are augmented or encumbered, depending on your perspective, by multiplicities of blogs with lesson plans, notes, clip art, musical compositions, and multiple translations of the scriptures, portable enough to fit in the palm of one's hand, no camel required. Moreover, these technologies are being developed and adopted at uneven rates in different parts of the world. The church's orderly regime of translation for growing church populations is unlikely to hold, as technological leapfrogging gives access to a wide array of information even before the arrival of official correlated print materials. And as the recent Big Love fracas painfully demonstrated, it's literally impossible for the church to keep anything sacred or secret. This situation creates a new set of incentives for the church in educating its members about its history and contemporary issues. It won't do anymore to simply insist that the Gospel Doctrine Manual is all there is. People will find out more. Of course, it would also be counterproductive for the church to use precious few hours of instructional time it has to engage in some program of inoculation. Instead, what is needed is to invite and teach both insiders and outsiders a new vocabulary and a new means of evaluating the authenticity and sincerity of sources of information about Mormonism. Younger Mormons, on the other hand, don't necessarily need to be taught those skills because they have them. They are used to evaluating sources of information on the internet. But the problem is that they are also used to choosing the sources of information that are most comfortable or entertaining to them. And so they need to be given a reason to care, a reason to bother to engage with Mormon studies, as well as the form to do it in. It's not clear to me, you will not be surprised to learn, exactly how those frameworks of engagement will develop. I want to suggest, though, that we might look to the history of the independent Mormon publishing sector for a potential model. For most of the decades during which the institutional church was working to impose coherence from the top down through correlation, Sunstone, Dialogue, Signature Books, Journal of Mormon History, Orientum, Exponent 2 were trying with widely varying degrees of success to create a coherent and recognizably Mormon culture from the bottom up. To be sure, editors and symposium organizers exercised a certain degree of control, financial imperatives, and varying levels of desire for approval or at least non-interference from institutional authority imposed limits and set boundaries. Nonetheless, these publications have, to borrow the Maussian framework, partially resisted the retrenchment that characterized the latter half of the 20th century. Their experience of the last several decades may be useful as we find ourselves at a moment where new kinds of assimilation are called for. Retrenchment in the wagon-circling, message-massaging mode of the past is simply impossible. With new scrutiny of Mormons and in an age where everything official and authoritative is suspect, the credibility of publishing organs that have stayed engaged with the professional methodologies and community is an important tool for the church. Just as the Woman's Exponent, the original one, usefully advertised the intelligence and independence of Mormon women to a watching world looking for duped victims of a polygamous patriarchy, the independent publishing sector can demonstrate the sincerity and the truthfulness of the church's claims that members think for themselves. In an age when Mitt Romney's perfect coiffure is adduced as evidence of the creepy and cult-like perfection imposed on members by a central board, it may be useful to occasionally trot out those of us whose bad hair days are well documented. And if these outlets are not always as orthodox as the church might hope, at least the flavors of their heresies are by now familiar. Finally, I did want to think about whether there are uniquely Mormon ways of thinking about this crisis in publishing that is really pretty universal, and whether there are Mormon ways of thinking about it that could help us navigate the crisis. One important aspect of Mormonism in this context is Mormonism's insistence that the spiritual and the temporal or physical are neither separate nor separable. That is, we have a mandate to regard the crisis of the publishing industry or the decline of museums or symphonies or operas as not merely economic problems, but as truly moral and spiritual questions. In a church that takes seeking after what is virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy as a religious imperative, even an article of faith, we have, or should have, a different perspective on these problems. It ought to matter to us whether our newspapers have the resources to do good reporting of the truth, whether our book-buying habits will sustain those who endeavor to produce what is lovely, whether we are dedicating our means and talents to the dissemination of truth in all its forms. Where the barrage of cheap distractions and entertainments is deadening and soul-crushing, we ought to regard resistance as a spiritual duty, not just a means of protecting our children's cognitive capacities or flattering our sense of our own superior aesthetics. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Mormon history also may offer a productive way to think about these questions. I want to close symbolizing this fruitful paradox with two objects from the period of Utah's colonization, the Lombardy poplar and the roof of the tabernacle. The Lombardy poplars that Wallace Stegner wrote of so movingly as Mormon trees grew quickly and made Utah towns seemed settled and beautified with a vigor and speed that matched the earnest industry and urgent sense of mission of the Mormon pioneers. But their rapid and narrow upward growth leaves them vulnerable, and they consequently have a relatively short lifespan. Another tree, the Western Red Pine, provided massive beams and girders hauled at tremendous cost in time and painful labor to build the roof of the tabernacle. This is so embarrassing. I was crying at the Museum of Church History looking at the roof, and I may well cry again. The tabernacle is a truly staggering architectural feat, massive in scale, painstakingly and exactingly crafted, and conceived to outlast the struggles of the early saints, built to endure long past the time when they mostly believed that the millennium would have arrived. It is a monument to the laborious pursuit of excellence, to struggle, to outrageous idealism, and economically absurd devotion to beauty and to truth. I say then, let 1,000 poplars bloom. May blogs and Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and zines and online journals flourish. And in the midst of them, let us be anxiously engaged with hewing joists, editing clean and beautiful sentences, with shrinking rawhide ties, sucking out unnecessary adjectival detritus, and fashioning wood bolts for nails, choosing perfect imagery and metaphors to hold together an edifice to the glory of the God who endowed us with a relentless yearning for beauty, excellence, and enduring perfection. If we build it, they may come. They may even pay.
Aren't you glad you came? Okay, we have 15 minutes for question and answers. If you'd use the microphone right here so that we can record your lovely voice and send it out to the masses.
Hi, I'm wondering if any of you have any experience with your web presence dealing with advertising. You know, now that we're seeing several Mormon blogs who are able to make a decent living professionally through accepting ads, I wonder if you have any philosophical feelings about that, if it might taint your academic cred, or anyway, how you all feel about that.
Well, I know that Sagal has chosen for the time being not to advertise, and it was an editorial decision just because, you know, we wanted to be independent in that aspect. So, others would be.
Irriantum has a very, very, very limited web presence. So even if we had ads, we'd probably make like 50 cents. That's one of our problems. That's, you know, talking about struggle, we really need to do a better job of changing with the times and having a better online presence. So.
As do we. Mike and I are going to talk for a long time.
Yeah, and Sunstone is actually a nonprofit corporation foundation, so we're not allowed to advertise anything that's not within our mission. So we couldn't make that decision based on principle.
This is also a financially based question. Following the way of the world, I wondered if any of you had considered requiring subvention, either from the author or from the author sponsor, to be published. Subvention is a professional fee.
Sounds like a great idea. I'll be honest that one of the most amazing things about Sunstone to me is the enormous time that people voluntarily put into creating the text that goes into this, because we have the authors who write and revise the text and send it in to me and go through a laborious editing process. Anybody who here has been edited by me knows.
Yes.
Yeah. there's Jonathan there. they put so much time into it, and all I do is send them 5 copies of the magazine, and it amazes me that I'm able to get out 5 issues a year on this total volunteer writing. I personally feel so deeply indebted to these people that I would feel like I was carving out one more circle of hell if I made pay for it. I don't know. That's just my idea, but maybe I should think about that.
I also think that you don't want to discourage anyone from coming to your publication with their scholarship, and I think that could be just one more barrier that they may choose some other journal to submit to.
I think in the humanities generally, it's less common to do that than in the sciences or in medicine. So to the extent that we're focused on humanities and jobs that never pay anyone very well. That it's less, it would be less common.
And with creative work, it's very important, I think, to avoid the taint of vanity publishing. And I think that we might run the risk of tilting in that direction, that if you didn't know if it was being printed on its merits or printed because we needed money. And so I think we would, even though it would be nice to have an extra revenue source, I think that it would have difficulties.
Okay. I have a set of questions, but I'll do them one at a time and then keep going back to the line until you run out of time. But a little louder, Jonathan. Okay. So, Stephen, you talked a little bit about working together and commonality in that. And, Christine, you mentioned something, as I recall, about, I forget, it connected, though, with my thought. It seems that communities are largely differentiating, or it seems to be going in the direction of micro-communities. And I guess what I'm wondering about is, how do we, the notion of commonalities, you were talking about the differences between the magazines and the communities there, and does that maybe be a disadvantage, but the flip side is that could be an advantage as well. I know that in the past, for instance, Linda Adams has talked about, they get things for BYU Studies to say, no, this isn't good for me, and I'll send it over to Dialogue, because it's a Dialogue sort of thing. I'm wondering if perhaps a more distinctive differentiation might actually be more constructive in terms of having multiple voices that speak with interest. I guess I'm just raising the question.
I like your scenario of this is something Christine and I do sometimes. We send each other stuff that doesn't fit the voice of our magazine. Yeah. Thanks, Christine. What I'd like to see is for the different journals to be very willing to do that sort of thing based on the voice of the magazine, rather than on perceived heterodoxy or orthodoxy. One of the things you guys may have been noticing about Sunstone, as I've been working on it, is that I'm taking it in a little bit more of a popular direction. Dan did a wonderful job with Sunstone and had a very scholarly tone to it because he has his PhD in philosophy, and that's what he enjoys. I was brought up in creative writing. Wayne Booth is one of my heroes, so I really appreciate really transparent, easy-to-access prose. And I also really enjoy a provocative and interesting visual style, and so you may have been noticing that that's the way that I've been heading. But see, with this new style, what I'm hoping it will do is draw out new content and new forms so that Dialogue and Erie Antrim can have as much as they need for their particular type of thing. I don't think we compete much with you. I don't know.
I don't know. I subscribe to both.
Oh, yeah. We did publish one of that girl with the blue hair.
Oh, Emily.
Emily, mm-hmm. What a marvelous writer.
Mm-hmm. She's amazing.
I would steal something from you of hers any day.
Well, she's an FMHer too.
It's so, true, she yeah. is.
We're lucky.
So yeah, based on voice instead of perceived orthodoxy, I'd love it if there were a big spectrum of that.
I was just going to say one thing really quick too. I think one thing that Stephen has really done well is that he's done a good job trying to help the editors of all these journals have a sense of community, where we are all kind of working together in a way that we know each other, that we have a relationship with one another. And I think that helps in that, you know, even just today talking to Stephen, I said, hey, you should check out this writer might be good for Sunstone, and we can kind of nudge different writers and different ideas past each other as a way to kind of encourage everybody's journals together in a sense of community, and I think that's one of the things that's been a very positive development recently.
Also, I think that from an economic standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to pick your niche and to focus on how else are you going to market your particular publication to a particular audience. And I think that BYU Studies in some ways struggles because it is so broad that someone looking for something in academia has become more and more specialized. And communities go for that specialization in some ways. They may pick up an issue of BYU Studies and there's nothing in there for them because they're not looking that broadly. They're wanting something very specific to what they're wanting. And so specialization makes sense from a marketing standpoint. And we all have, in some ways, the same topics that we're covering because we're dealing with Latter-day Saints, although BYU Studies does poetry, not fiction. And so we have no competition there. But I think that, as they've already said, the voice and the tone and the specific way of dealing with different topics is unique in all of these journals, and that may be what ends up attracting a particular individual to one journal over another.
The other thing that I would say, just really quickly, is, you know, at least from the perspective of Segala, we might attract a slightly different audience, but I know that I have people who have subscribed to Segala, and then I know that, and then have become exposed to the other independent publications through that. So we're kind of the gateway drug. So so that, I mean, when if you come from a certain part of a niche market, you'll gain. I think you kind of get a greater picture of everything else. But even if you might originally kind of fall into one demographic.
I was very intrigued by Mike's comment about having interviews of the authors as kind of a podcast on the side. It seems to me like that's a wonderful idea for any of the journals. I don't know if you're familiar with the Barnes & Noble Meet the Writers podcast, but you could have something that could be subscribed to via iTunes, and it doesn't compete with your journal, because when you listen to these little 5-minute interviews of the author, kind of learn about them and their background, what they were trying to accomplish in the book or the article. You don't have the article, but it makes you very curious about it. So, in terms of marketing, I think it's a wonderful idea.
Sort of a lure. Huh?
Yeah.
We did that on our blog. I don't know if you guys do.
Yeah. I was going to say something sort of similar to that. I'm associated with National Public Radio, and we know that our radio listening audience is, the average age is 50 years old, and that our online audience is 35 years old. And our feeling is that the future is really with the online, and you approach the material differently, but you need to have it on all platforms.
I've been worrying over something that you said in the very beginning.
I'm really glad you're worrying about me, because I need this.
Well, it was the comment, the reference to some guy I interviewed in Dialogue who said that he mistrusted Mormon academics and intellectuals because he felt that rather than trying to get other people to understand them, they should try to understand the larger context they're in. The larger context of Mormonism. Do you see the irony with the largest proselytizing church in the goddamn world going out and trying to tell everybody else we have the truth, accept it, and saying, you know, you people who have a slight problem with proselytizing, with you who proselytize to others need to understand this larger group that proselytizes to the entire world? And I love your idea of inclusion and cooperation and everything, but perhaps what we need is not cooperation and more inclusion among different Mormon publications, but maybe we need to reach out to the rest of the world.
I love that. That's a great idea.
And it's not, you know, don't specialize our niches more to reach to more particular Mormons. let's engage with the world and let's make ourselves relevant to the world in all our glorious weirdness. And I mean, let's not dilute who we are, but let's engage with the world instead of just making sure that we proselytize among each other. Let's stop proselytizing. Let's ask the rest of the world what they think of us. I mean, why not have an issue of Sunstone entirely by non-members talking about Mormonism?
Well, that'd be fine.
That's been actually one of my goals for Dialogue, is to have at least one non-Mormon voice in every issue, and so far we have, and you'll be happy to know that the first sermon by a non-Mormon will be published in Dialogue.
That is
in the spring issue.
Cool.
That's great.
Cool.
Oh, I don't know, because, okay, I've seen three people move: Janet, Darlene, and then Kim, and then we're done.
Well, I appreciate the idea both of reaching out to each other in the Mormon nation, if you will, and those out, but I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive, so I agree both with you and with Holly. As someone who taught at a Jesuit university, I was intrigued though to see, we had a subscription to BYU Studies, and I used to work at BYU Studies before I went to taught at the Jesuit school, and the academics that found out where I went to undergraduate said that they appreciated the journal exactly because it helped them understand BYU and the culture from which I hail. So I think that maybe foregrounding our peculiarities can be helpful both for helping us understand others and helping them understand us. We can't understand others from a one-sided thing. So I think you have to do those things in concert. We have to help understand ourselves and understand people outside and help them understand each other. I don't think those are mutually exclusive things. But one thing I wanted to ask you, and maybe it's too broad of a question, but to what degree is talking about solidifying our niche markets, or you used to talk, Stephen, about how we defined ourselves against each other and how that might have been useful originally and how sometimes it can be harmful now. But to what degree does discussing that make a perception real? Sometimes I think that the segregation between journals is more perceptual than real. BYU Studies is supposedly a very conservative journal. It's published an essay I wrote about being raped, which doesn't seem very conservative. So I wonder if when we talk about this is what this journal does, this is what this journal does, if we're actually creating something that didn't exist previous to the conversation. Or maybe I'm full of it.
Since those were Stephen's deep thoughts, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Don't pass it to me. I'll use this. I would argue that the perception does create the reality. I agree with you. One of my writers in a previous issue, when she told her parents that she'd been published in Sunstone, they were like, ah! And then she said, well, I've known this guy for 5 years. He's my friend. I know how he works. I know his philosophy. And this is going to be, it's a very constructive magazine. And so they said, okay. And they came and they read it. And they said, well, look at this. I mean, my mom now just subscribes to Sunstone. And she was afraid for my soul when I first got the job. So the perception for me, from what I can see, is very strong. And so little by little, see, when Sunstone started, it was started by faithful academics, and it did things during its tenure that were publicized or not publicized. I think Sunstone has done great things for Mormon culture, but a few things brought us down for some reason. And I think it's time to start saying, we're a community of saints. We're going to have different voices, but we're going, I think I'm going in a different direction than you're saying. But what I'm hoping to do is to change that perception, because I think what we have is a difference of voices here, not a difference of orthodoxy. I would be happy to argue with someone on that. If
I had a comment on that too. I think at BYU Studies, we consider every topic that comes to us Like you said, there's personal essays, and it dealt with the topic that you may not expect BYU Studies to deal with. We've had non-members who have published articles in BYU Studies. I think that what we look for are is it sound scholarship? Is it well written? And we also look to see if the tone is appropriate. We do, I think there is a certain tone at BYU Studies. It's more about building up what is right and not tearing down. We don't particularly like that contentious tone, and so you're probably best to go somewhere else if you have a publication like that. But I think that a manuscript that way, but I think that all of us can, I think definitely there, a journal by its editor and the people that work there, such as Stephen's journal is not going to be the same one as Dan's journal before, because there's going to be perhaps a different tone, and I think the people that work with the editors and work together, they create that tone, and you get readers that either that appeals to them or it doesn't appeal to them, and I think that that is a big part of attracting your readers. It's that sense of community. Either they feel like they are part of that community and they can fit in there and they're comfortable with it, or they're not.
Okay, Darlene, and then Kim. She had her hand up first. Sorry, Kim.
Just really quickly. Peer review. Do any of you have it? If you don't, have you considered it? And if you do, what are the benefits?
BYU Studies does have peer review. It's a very important part of the journal, and we get peer reviewers. That's what I said was one of our difficulties, is finding people who are specialists and can look at the content and say, this is accurate and this is relevant information and important, and we will even, they're not necessarily LDS people that reviewers, they can be non-LDS as well. We want a specialist who can really tell us that this is an important piece, and so I think that the peer review is very important.
Generally speaking, with a literary magazine, it's not always seen as quite as important as would be in a scholarly magazine to have peer review. However, I will say that the vast majority of fiction and creative nonfiction that we publish has been submitted to us through our contests. This year we received 70 short stories in our fiction contest and over 40 essays in our creative nonfiction contest. And the winners were chosen by a committee of very qualified people. So I do believe that we have a rigorous selection process in that respect.
We peer review everything, and if it's hard for BYU Studies to find that many people, it's even harder for me, because there's just one of me, and my crackpot editorial board that's like, what, 10 people. So it's hard, but it's really worth it, because I've read a lot of books, but not nearly enough to, you know, to know what to tell an author about a particular article. I can edit for tone, and I can edit for grammar and syntax, and I can give someone a general idea, but we really need specialists in the field, and especially when it comes to fiction and poetry, you know, I can say stuff, but I feel not at all qualified. So peer reviewers are really important for that.
We have a process similar to what I would say Angela does, where we go through, we have a contest which is reviewed by our editorial board, and then we also have a really, I would say, pretty rigorous editing process on everything that we go through. And I edit features, so I often have to do quite a bit of research on my own to make sure that I feel up to snuff all the various topics that we have come through our way. So.
And I am master of my magazine. No, I get help when I need it.
Well, I actually know John Peters from his PhD program, and I respect him tremendously. And I feel like, for my own moral development, listening to the people that I don't always agree with is good, and I do that on Sundays and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, I do a lot of that, but I don't do enough to be actually morally developed yet. But I want a conversation that is, you talked about a conversation that was both broad and deep, okay? I went in your comment, you used these words about it, and I worry, I may have misunderstood you. As we try to have a broader conversation and understand more people, 90% of the time we go for least common denominator kinds of things. We find things that we can talk about that don't feel contentious, or we don't feel like we're disturbing people and they don't get mad at us. But I want a serious conversation.
Certainly, I want
to change. It's not that I want to change the church in the way that people are worried about, but I want to change the experience of being in the church and help us realize our potential as, I don't know, I love the phrase last night from the Community of Christ, as a revelatory people, and not just people who are quoting other people or who are trying to find things to feel good about.
I love it, Kim. That's exactly what I'm thinking. One of my favorite books is The Different Drum by M. Scott Peck, and in it he describes the steps of coming into community. And he says that we always start out being nice to each other. We're in pseudo community. We're trying to stay away from the things that we know are going to get down deep inside of us. And you can't have any kind of good conversation when you do that. But heading into that, you do have to go through a chaos. You have to go to a part where you realize, yes, we have differences. But then he says you need to get to the part where you empty yourself out and you say, okay, we have differences, but what we're trying to do here is understand each other. We're not here to convert each other. We're not here to heal each other, because my definition of healing may be different from yours. My definition of truth may be on top different than yours. And as soon as we get all that out of the way, then we can sink into community and we can listen to each other as real people and be willing to go to those places where it's difficult, because we trust each other to be able to talk sincerely and deeply and be willing to confront each other, be willing to be changed ourselves. And that's what you really need to do, is to be willing to change yourself. And you find that reciprocates. When you're with a person who's willing to be changed, him or herself, you reciprocate and all your defenses come down. So yes, I want to get past the least common denominator. I'm willing to head into chaos, and I want us to empty out and start listening to each other, and that's a huge process. I don't know if it would actually have to work. You guys have anything to say on that? Okay, we're done. Thanks, everybody.